When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books and Psychoanalysis, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Our guest for the episode is Dr. Helena Vissing. Dr. Vissing is a licensed psychologist and somatic experiencing practitioner based in Northern California. She is certified in perinatal mental health and specializes in trauma treatment and psychodynamic psychotherapy. She joins us today to talk about her new book, Somatic Maternal Healing, Psychodynamic and Somatic Trauma Treatment for Perinatal Mental Health, published 2023 by Routledge. And joining me, this is my first time doing this, I have a co-host, my colleague here in New York. My colleague is Golzar Selby Nagchane. She is a training and supervising licensed psychoanalyst with special expertise in reproductive and maternal mental health. She created and built Network for the Advancement of Perinatal Support, an integrative mental health program for OBGYN offices and fertility clinics that she launched in 2014 at the renowned Downtown Women OBGYN practice in New York City. Nagchane is also teaching faculty at the New York Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and the Center for Modern Psychoanalytic Studies here in New York. We both just finished our semester. Golzar, thank you for joining me as a host. And Helena, thanks for joining us for the book.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a psychoanalytic podcast. We begin with the question, Helena, as far as we can know our own motivations, what motivated you to write the book?
Yeah, so I started my interest in the topic of specifically motherhood, the transition to motherhood, and then maternal mental health way back. I actually started specializing in developmental psychology, play therapy. I was a school psychologist, but something was drawing me to then understand that, go deeper into specifically for motherhood. So that started way back. Also, when I came to the U.S. in 2010 and did my dissertation, I was called to that topic and was already interested in it from a psychoanalytic or psychodynamic perspective. But I then, as I was going on with my training, deepening my training, I started training in somatic approaches, somatic experiencing. And when I started that training, I was really excited to learn a new modality to deepen my work in the maternal mental health specialization. And I was a bit surprised, also a bit disappointed when I discovered that in that pretty big community of somatic training or somatic practitioners, there was not really a subgroup of specifically maternal mental health adaptations. a lot of people would say they work with perinatal, say, yeah, sure, perinatal, but more like working with babies and working with families. And although I also love infant mental health and family mental health, that particular focus on the mother's perspective was missing. And I was really kind of struck by this lack, like that there was this like I had my two legs in these two fields. I was very, very inspired by these two areas. And I couldn't find that like solid bridge. So it felt very, I was really drawn to this work of like bridging the two. I became very motivated, determined to create a bridge between the two. And certainly also on the personal side, I had my first child as I was doing my dissertation, focusing on psychology of motherhood. And then my second child I had some 10 years later while writing this book. So there's certainly also that background of my personal experiences with the perinatal transition.
Great. Golsanar and I spoke briefly this morning. Golsanar, I'm going to give you the first question. You zeroed in on something in the book that you're very interested in.
Yeah. You know, as a perinatal practitioner and somebody who works with, IVF populations, people who are going through fertility treatments, I've become increasingly aware the role hormones plays, which I think is sometimes, especially within psychoanalytic community, sometimes we forget the reality of biology. And that has become more and more top of mind for me. I'm reading a fantastic book about how our hormones are changed by birth control. And so we have all this data. We know that people who suffer from postpartum depression are more likely to have perimenopausal or menopausal depression. So we see that there are hormonal elements. Something I loved about the book was how much you really touch on the biological changes during the perinatal period, postpartum, in PTSD. One section was about how trauma was nuancing our understanding of oxytocin. I would love to hear a little bit of how hormones play a role and how you work with that in a somatic way.
Yes. Yeah. And to that, I want to say that the biopsychosocial, not just the model, but I like the term biopsychosocial clinical way of thinking. It's like a clinical attitude. I have found that in just the guiding principle for this field, because it has always frustrated me when I was studying maternal mental health or motherhood, when I was like really feeling I had to jump from one paradigm to the other, and the paradigms were not connecting, were not communicating. So it would only be like classic psychodynamic approaches that was purely focusing on the psychological, or was purely biologic biomedical research, just only looking at the hormonal piece. And I was frustrated by that, because we know all of this interact. I mean, I know from all of my clinical experience, I see it just really interacting in so many ways, and my own personal experience, of course. That the biopsychosocial framework way of thinking helped me to just constantly look at, we're always digging into the research, the knowledge, the theories from the different paradigms, and then seeing how they inform each other back and forth. And the thing is that it can really enrich in our work. For example, like we know the enormous intensity of the hormonal shifts of the perinatal transitions will impact emotional health and mental health, or just your inner state, right? A psychodynamic attitude, when you can really engage with the biomedical research, you can also kind of bring that subjective experience to those huge changes, right? To make sense of that, so it's not one or the other. Like, to give an example of how extreme it is, like I work with people where they might have had very, very little, very low symptoms of like anxiety in the OCD realm, but the maternal transition will trigger intense high levels of OCD symptoms that we know have a very big hormonal neurological component to it. And then, for example, sometimes it's the breastfeeding, lactation. Sometimes it's that IVF treatment. Sometimes it's just a pregnancy ending. Sometimes it's the big shifts biologically really showing also a big change in the emotional inner state. And instead of saying, oh, it's just purely biology, right? That's why you were depressed or anxious, right? That's it. We can make use of that to understand, well, what was the experience of going through such a hormonal roller coaster? How do you make sense of that? And how did that play into the rest of that whole transition, life transition, relational transition, all of that on the psychological level? So the way then I work with that somatically is that you have to be very thorough in the psychoeducation about this, about how, yes, there's a lot we know, but at the same time, there's always the things we don't know. And so often I see in this field that people come in, understandably so, with this desire to like, let's pinpoint the one explanation, the one factor, because that gives kind of that promise. It's like that, like enigmatic, like the answer, the key. And unfortunately, we have to work on sitting with like, there's never one answer, right? Maybe it was the hormones of lactation or not lactating, that was a big factor. Maybe it was also other things. Maybe it was the psychological significance of that whole feeding journey that was playing into it too, activating feelings and memories and relational dynamics, right? So there's never just one explanation. And in the somatic, what's important from the somatic perspective is that we're not coming from it from this idea of like that we can just regulate a person out of this overwhelm. That's unrealistic. These forces are so intense for some people who have this big concoction of vulnerabilities from biological vulnerabilities, social and psychological vulnerabilities. No matter how much somatic work you do, you can't just get them into a complete state of like perfect bliss and stability, because that, on a more existential level, this seismic shift in their lives is still going on. So that's my approach in that, and I think the more you work with this, the more you just see how intense these life changes are, especially the biological too. And also the clash, there's something about the clash between nature and culture, the reproductive life cycles, like the perinatal transition really confronts us with the clash between nature, our biology, and culture, like nothing else.
So with the biopsychosocial, you write that biopsychosocial clinical thinking is a reflexive process rather than a protocol. Can you sort of explain that thought?
Yes. So the visual I have is the different big kind of circles that overlap of the different paradigms. I mean, the biopsychosocial, we know there's been a lot of critique of that model, right? It could be limiting. I think it's not exhaustive. There's more circles or paradigms to add for certain, besides from the bio and the psycho and the social, for example, the spiritual. But I like the visualization of it with these different paradigms that I made a graph where they are like just overlapping. And I like that image because it helps me to think about how, you know, we are always kind of looking, zooming in on, okay, what's going on in some of these circles here, what's going on this area, this, and we do that like investigative work that our, you know, clinical work is too, and referring and testing and consulting and collaborating with other providers, you know, ideally it's not happening enough, unfortunately, but there should be that collaborating with the other providers. And then whenever we're discovering a piece in one of these areas, we should be asking ourselves, well, how does that then impact what's going on in the other areas, the other from other paradigms? So I see it as this like dynamic process of like jumping back and forth of like thinking about, okay, what are we dealing with here? And for example, I work a lot with perinatal psychiatrists. We need more of those. We really need psychiatrists to train in this. It's a really specialized, you know, subfield of psychiatry. And I have been so lucky to collaborate with some people who are really talented, where they really can grasp all these nuances. And when they're in that process of having to try out, for example, different medications, and then to really consider, okay, so what's going on there? What do we know of typical responses and reactions to the different, you know, the symptoms, the symptomology, and then the different psychotropic options? And how does that respond to other things going on emotionally? You know, what's the more prevalent issue, right? Are we seeing a more of a depressed, collapsed state? Or are we seeing that super high hypervigilance anxiety? Or what's the presentation for the clinical picture? So the biopsychosocial, like, clinical approach helps me to constantly see how the different paradigms are interacting, are informing each other. And it's overwhelming, right? That just speaks to the overwhelm for our clients. But in that, I find that there's a potential for really empowering our clients to see it as like the more they can also adapt this like dynamic clinical or dynamic biopsychosocial thinking, the more they can also feel empowered in expanding their way of thinking of the many layers of what they're going through. It's overwhelming, but there's also something empowering about that. I see that a lot. And these years, we're seeing this like wave of literature around motherhood, reproduction, maternal mental health, all trauma too. And I see many of these books, memoir, nonfiction, and fiction, I see this more and more voices speaking to this. For a good example of that is Lucy Jones, a UK-based writer. She wrote a book, Matrescence, on the metamorphosis of pregnancy, childbirth, and childbirth, came out, I think, this year. And it was amazing to read it, and I've connected with her because she writes like nonfiction memoir style, and it's a beautiful poetic biopsychosocial journey where she goes into biology and psychology. She references analysts, and she also goes deep into the psychosocial research. So it's also this. So I really see this like thirst for this, of like we are inundated with information today. How do we find a way where that becomes an empowering journey of like riding the waves and feeling the dynamics of the interplay, the way the paradigms can inform each other, as opposed to just only the overwhelm of the information overload.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Well,
I love the way.
No, go ahead, Gulzar. Yeah.
I love the way that you're bringing in the different dynamics, because I think that's so much it. So often patients come into the room and they're like, what is causing this? And they want it to be just the hormones or just one thing. But really, it's this like full picture, and you describe it in a really wonderful way.
Yeah. And Gulzar, when Helena said we need more psychiatrists in this world, you affirmed that. That's your finding as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, reproductive psychiatry is such a important specialization, and it's so hard to find them. And they're often, because of that, very expensive. And so there's always this big struggle trying to help perinatal patients find a reproductive psychiatrist that they can work with. And the problem is, because the field is changing so quickly and so often, just going to a regular psychiatrist, I think, will miss a lot of what Helena is saying.
And is that a blind spot or a training, or what leads them to miss it?
Well, I know that in New York, we have some really amazing training centers that are, Cornell is producing a lot of really wonderful reproductive psychiatrists. But from my experience, and Helena, I'd love to hear from your experience as well. I think it's just that psychiatrists can't be up to date on the latest research for perinatal populations, because it has not been something that they have traditionally focused on. And there's a lot of fear around prescribing or not prescribing within the perinatal population, prescribing because of pregnancy or breastfeeding, and not prescribing because of kind of the elevated fears around postpartum psychosis and potential like suicide or infanticide.
Yes, definitely. That's also my experience. You bringing up a number of those things. These barriers here, they. It's interesting about the barriers specific to this question of reproductive psychiatry really reflects a lot about the wider issue. So like there's like lack of specialized training, right? I mean, there are some good sites. I mean, I was in Los Angeles for many years, and the UCLA, they have a wonderful program there, and they had some pioneers there doing research. But you know, those are in the big cities, right? The big hubs. But it's not, you don't have those opportunities for a lot of psychiatrists to get that specialized training. So, I mean, that's just there, right? A lack of opportunities for specialized training. I mean, it's coming along. It's certainly growing these years a lot. Over the last 10 years, it's been growing enormously, but there's still a ways to go. It's a subspecialty with a lot of risks, right? There's a lot of liability. We know it's very high risk. Not just like your outpatient low to medium risk issues, but certainly the more higher risk with severe mental illness, right? We know the risks are very high, very tricky to deal with. It needs a lot of support when we're talking about, for example, more severe mental illness, or could be, for example, bipolar disorder or postpartum psychosis, right? It requires a whole system, right? A whole system of care. And being a psychiatrist in private practice, you're one person. That's a lot. I mean, you would ideally need a whole group, right? A team. I mean, I have been able to sometimes work with people where we create a team where I work with the psychiatrist and with a social worker and other people around, and obviously the family members, the partner. It's in that way, our systems of care, right, the way things are very siloed, really show the problems with this. Then there's also that question of lack of research when it comes to prescribing. It's a big issue. It's so much an issue that the researchers themselves are now saying, like, this is a problem. The way that traditionally, if you know, pregnancy has been like an automatic exclusion criteria because we have to protect, right? We cannot, you know, do these trials. And that's coming from a motivation of protection, right? We want to protect. But what's sad is that ultimately we end up actually putting mothers and parents at higher risk because we don't have the knowledge, we don't have the enough data and research. So it's a very difficult dilemma, but researchers are now saying that we need to open up to do more research. We need to, that we have been overly protective, right? The protection has gone to it's become like too much, so much that we're not producing knowledge that we could actually do. I have to say, I see a parallel of this in the somatic world too. It's a very common thing among body psychotherapists or somatic therapists to say, you can't do somatic work during pregnancy, as like a blanket statement, which obviously for someone like me, that really irks me because it's very problematic with this blanket statement of saying, no, we can't do any somatic treatment during pregnancy. Because of course, you can't do intense somatic trauma resolution interventions during pregnancy if it's going to cause a lot of overwhelm. But we never do that if it's causing enormous overwhelm. I mean, solid body psychotherapy or somatically informed modalities are always about ensuring stability and, you know, stabilizing before. Like you can't just go in and overwhelm. I mean, there's some people doing that, but that's general consensus in the field, that is that there needs to be solid stability and relational support before you gently build up resources through working with somatic techniques. So I see this like hesitancy, and I think it's partly coming from this good intention of wanting to protect. I wonder if there's also unconscious dynamics at play. My analytic thinking tells me that we also, we know we have some like collective things about the maternal pregnancy, the pregnant body, the maternal subjectivity. If we were going to go deep into the psychoanalytic and philosophical theories, I mean, we have some stuff there around that on a collective level. Avoidance, I would be a word that comes to mind for me.
Well, yeah, you mentioned.
Also...
Go ahead, Golzar.
Sorry. Also the reality that, you know, women's health is far less funded and pays far less than other equivalent kind of men's health things. So there is also an institutional resistance, which I think calls back to the psychoanalytic resistances. It's rooted in that no one talks about.
We should talk about it. We're here today. Helena, when you talk about avoidance, you have a section on avoidance and dissociation, and it reminded me of one of our thinkers, in the what's called the Modern Psychoanalytic School in New York. There are certain characters that the whole of their affect, I'm quoting, their whole of their affective life has been influenced by the need to avoid the feeling of hate inside themselves. What feelings are being avoided that you're talking about? What's being dissociated that turns protection into exclusion and neglect of care or research?
I love this question because this is I love this psychoanalytic question because that is one of the pieces besides from all the other pieces is the real gift of going deep into the psychoanalytic and feminist and philosophical insights on this. Because when you really dig into the literature there, it's this, you know, the body really comes up, right? The body in all its, meanings, right? The actual concrete physical body and the maternal, perinatal, postpartum, pregnant body is just the body that more than anything confronts us, confronts us with embodiment in itself, with our vulnerability, in all the ways that that also confronts us with, you know, mortality, all the intense things. Jacqueline Rose has said, right, like that the mother in that way is the, you know, the archetypally, symbolically, the giver of life, but the shadow side of that is that she's also the reminder of death. And it really confronts us. And then from the relational school, I'm very informed by the modern relational school, specifically Jessica Benjamin's work and others, where, you know, that our encounter with otherness, that's our big issues as in humanity, right? That's our blessing and our issue. It's where we really are confronted. And what is that encounter with otherness like? Concretely, it's embodied, right? It's our corporeal reality that starts with where we come from, and we come from another body. And the fact that we come from another body, that is also how we discover ourselves as embodied subjects. And it is in that field there of the maternal bodily relations, that the affective field, that we come into being. And I think it's something we struggle with collectively and individually. I'm also working a lot on trying to get a sense, and speaking of the biopsychosocial, is to get a sense of that also in a historical perspective of, like, why is it we struggle with it? What is it about our particular time in history? And speaking from where I'm working from and writing from, it is, you know, a modern era, digitalized modern era in Western culture. And there's been some great analysis looking at how there's something about the maternal body and the bodily realms of the maternal that we come from that the modern individual, the individual subject in modernity, has been defined in opposition to that. So this idea we have today of being individuals, the way we understand ourselves, it's like, well, that is because you grow up and you separate and you come out of that and to become a wholly defined subject. And the maternal body, the maternal subject, a mother, and I also think it largely, I mean, in all other ways, also all parents, but particularly mothers in my work, that is a person that will just disrupt or challenge the very idea of the isolated subject. I mean, concretely, pregnancy disrupts it. You're not one, you're not two. And that continues in the postpartum. So I think there's something really deeper on the deeper philosophical level here about how the maternal challenges us at this time in history and in our particular Western cultural sphere that I see come out as these the symptoms of that are, like, for example, the issues with the institutional fragmentation of care, things like that. You know, even with the advances of the biomedical model, there's great advances. Of course, there are lots of forces also trying to implement the biopsychosocial perspective. I reference a lot of that literature of these very good attempts within the biomedical model to bring in a more holistic thinking. But even still, it is that idea, like that idea of the body as a machine, right? It's like the mechanical, it's still fragmented, right? It's like, oh, how do we just solve, you know, there's an illness, or, you know, we want to just solve that. And it's still very hard for the biomedical model to fully grasp the question of subjectivity that we, of course, in our field of psychotherapy, that's our big focus there.
So many thoughts. I'm thinking, though, about seeing the maternal body as other and relational. I had two thoughts. One, a woman who wrote her final paper in our school, she was pregnant and had a patient who just didn't even see it. She was showing and, you know, about to and had a complete blindness to it. But I'm going back to the idea of we must protect, and the idea that the ego ideal is what is both desired to be returned to, and of course protecting the ego ideal in the unconscious. Is the mother's body unconsciously not seen? Is it a narcissistic identification, and is an ego ideal that's being protected that of course ends up preventing real care? And this is a brand new question that just came to me. So,
yeah, that's a good question. I think because it's a good question, and I really grapple with this because I think it's important to not just say, oh, you know, we just struggle with acknowledging the way we all come from, you know, the realm of the maternal body, and we just have to embrace it and come back to it. But it's not that simple because we cannot just give up or you know throw out the idea of like subjectivity as we understand it here. I think it's a dilemma. I mean, it's a big dilemma we're dealing with here. The example you mentioned it's quite rare, but it does happen, right? The pregnancy denial. Of course, we have to consider, right, that it's a concern, right? We would certainly be concerned, and as always, we have to be so mindful of not pathologizing or not, you know, clinical rarities are always ripe for projections, right? Really ripe for some projections of pathology. Right? Because like, for example, we could say, oh my God, this person must have had some really serious trauma causing some severe dissociation. Likely. And also who knows what could be going on neurologically, biologically that is just maybe challenging that connection combined with whatever, you know, developmental trauma there could be, right? Who knows if there's something that is like, you know, some women don't feel movements of the baby, and some women feel it a lot, right? It's this big interplay between, you know, the whatever your like biological situation is, and then what your experiences were. But it's interesting that because there's this romanticized idea about the mother being so devoted and connected to the baby fully. So that clinical rarity, we would say, whoa, that's so awful. The disconnected expecting mother, that's like a horror situation. But the truth is that those feelings of disconnect are so common. You know, it's so common to experience this like enormous sense of fragmentation and feeling disconnected from your body. I talk in the book about like what it's like to mother from a traumatized body self, and how tons of women parents they do it anyway. They do it, and it feels like the most impossible thing to do, and they do it, and they have to do it, right? They go through it. I work with people all the time that just, you know, you have to do it. And so that is our reality, right? It's not like we have this like perfect, pure, perfectly healthy version of that. You know, that's a fantasy, that the perfect mother who's perfectly attuned and aligned, that's a fantasy, there's no real actual people out there in the world who are completely pure and going through that maternal transition without upheaval and overwhelm and struggle. I mean, and that it kind of captures our humanity in that way. I often say like it would actually be the greatest tragedy if you were born by parents who did not get their hearts completely cracked up and overwhelmed and had their whole lives turned upside down by your birth. I think that's actually that would be a tragedy in itself because it's the significance of the child being born, right? It's a human being. It's the deep significance. Yeah, I'm sorry. I might have gotten off on a few tangents there.
That resonates so much. It is actually so critical because it means you're attuned, and to feel nothing and to be unchanged is far more concerning. I love what you're saying.
You mentioned Jacqueline Rose, who's been on this program and talked about that, Jessica Benjamin. Something that struck me, can you talk about, and you also talked about being empowered just now, the difference between empowered mothering and feminist mothering, and then what are the five tenets of empowered mothering?
Yes, so, I love that we're getting to this piece, which is the macrocentric feminism or the psychosocial piece, because that's a really important piece to nuance when we talk about like psychoanalytic and psychological things and then the biomedical. So the more of the social or psychosocial realm, the field of macrocentric feminism is crucial there and really offers an important level of analysis and critical thinking about the societal context of that. This is a field started by or developed by Andrea O'Reilly and many others. But the idea there is this idea of patriarchal motherhood or institutionalized motherhood, looking at the social institution of motherhood and the pressure of that on the collective level, and that being different from the individual's potential for mothering or parenting. And this goes back to a Rich famous distinction here. She did this distinction back in the 70s. And that distinction, that way of thinking it's been crucial to separate these two and to really see in real life it's very hard. So much of my work with my clients is about just sitting in the mess of like which is which, and it's impossible. But these concepts are so helpful because you can ask yourself, well, what's going on here? Am I trying to live up to these culturally prescribed ideas about what quote unquote good mothering is, right? Living up to these roles? Or am I discovering my mothering as an expression of myself, like my subjectivity being transformed now into being a maternal subject, and therefore my mothering being an expression of that. So the mothering is not this like performance or this like technique or this like objectively correct way of doing something, like caregiving as this like objective truth, but as an expression of who you are, embedded in also your own personal and cultural context, right? Because there's no such thing as one perfect way of mothering. And when you can really separate those two or distinguish them and assert and discover your own expression and your potentials there, that is empowered, right? Because it's empowered, it's becoming empowered to not be dominated by dictates from institutionalized or patriarchal motherhood. So the difference between empowered mothering and feminist mothering is that feminist mothering is empowered mothering that where you specifically identify as feminist, right? And the reason why it's important to distinguish is that there are mothers and parents out there who do not identify as feminists, but they are doing things their own way. For all kinds of reasons. And they are not living up to the dictates of patriarchal motherhood, either because they're not able to, or because they don't want to. So consider things like single moms or moms, parents in different family formations, right? You know, there are aspects of it they're not able to live up to this ideal of the ideal mother, but maybe they just don't want to for whatever reason that is. They don't want to live up to, for example, these expectations of, for intensive mothering, that mothering is supposed to be so enormously intense because they don't want to. So that's important to distinguish there, to be careful not to kind of continue like an imposing of ideas, right? Like, for example, feminist ideas. So you don't impose that. And I find that helpful in my work because it's very, I certainly work with people who will identify as feminists and say that that's really important to them. And they have a very enriching process of discovering that and asserting themselves within the understanding of feminism. And I also have some where that wouldn't resonate for them for different reasons. And it's important to be respectful of that. And then what was the other question you asked me about the tenets of?
Well, yeah, I think you have 5 tenets of empowered mothering.
Yes, I have them. Let's see if I can remember them. At their A's, the 5 A's. What I found so interesting with these is, and I had studied these tenets are from Andrea O'Reilly. I had studied these a long time ago, and then I had done more somatic training, trauma training, studied this, and what was really interesting to me is that these central tenets of empowered mothering really align with our thinking in like trauma-informed or trauma-responsive care. And O'Reilly, while she's certainly very well-versed in psychology, she's not a mental health professional. That's not like her perspective. And the 5 tenets are agency, autonomy, authenticity, authority, and advocacy or activism. And agency is something we also talk a lot about from a somatic perspective, where it's a focus of somatic techniques of like, how do you build up a sense of agency? What I love about the somatic approach is that agency becomes very concrete. It is not this like abstract idea of like, I can move through the world with like a sense of having agency, of being the author of my life. It's like concretely, what is agency experienced in the body? It's that I feel capable of responding to my sensations and what is going on in my body in a way where I can kind of ride the waves of my nervous system and I have agency in what I'm choosing to do, as opposed to when you're having anxiety attack where you feel powerless to the sensations of anxiety. So we work a lot on that. Like we take it down to the smallest increments of that, like the experience of like, I have agency to open and close my eyes because just to experience the agency or to even reduce stimulation, right? Like I work a lot on that level because that's like the building blocks of what eventually builds up to a larger sense of agency in your life, in your relationships, in your life as a whole. Of course, with that comes also autonomy, where, you know, a sense of yourself where you get to choose, you know, how are you choosing to mother? How are you choosing what to do? I see so much of this understandable longing for answers for how to do mothering or parenting the best way, how to do the whole sleeping or all of that. And there's certainly good people out there offering great insights on what for parenting and children. But I feel like the number one thing is to look at, well, what feels like, what does it feel like, the choices? What does it feel like? That sense of like autonomy or the way you respond to it yourself, the way the individual mother feels like, to create that sense of like, what is working for me? How can I tune in? And that's not going to be a perfect answer because ambivalence, right? We can feel very ambivalent. So much of parenting is about oh, I want to do this, but I also don't want to do it. I'm torn between this. Parenting is just one long line of dilemmas. But the more we can practice that sense of tuning into your own subjective experience and how you're navigating the dilemma and what can then feel good, and then connect that to the nervous system experience of what feels good. I think that is needed for building that, what we call empowered mothering, right? It's like, it's not whether you live up to some prescribed idea about what good mothering is. It's, does your body tell you that? Can you, like, your body will tell you if it feels like it's resonating, if there's balance. And your body is not going to be able to tell you, oh, it's all perfect, but there will be enough sense of like authenticity and integrity and alignment with a sense of self when you're navigating the dilemmas of parenting.
So in terms of bodily resonance, there was a section of the book that I'd love to know more about, you know, from the clinical point of view, from the clinician side, because you say, you write, my hope is that by reading this book as a clinician, you will feel less apprehension about the tender work of trauma healing in the perinatal period. What are the somatic countertransferences specific to the perinatal transition? What's happening in the countertransferences for us, for the analyst?
Yeah. And I love this question, because this is where the psychoanalytic approach and the somatic can really cross-pollinate and enrich each other here. I'm very inspired by Susie Orbach. She's really done some amazing work in this area, because the somatic countertransference is really crucial, because it's not enough to have that cognitive awareness of your own biases and have that reflective process of like, oh, I have this thought or feeling come up in my countertransference, and how can I use that as information? Like, that needs to be connected on a bodily level, because there's going to be so much nonverbal relational communication going on, where that upheaval, that state of overwhelm that the client is going to be in, is going to impact you also on a bodily level. I think it would be concerning to think you can work with someone who's in that state, right, of the maternal transition, and think that you can respond to that purely from a mental state. We need, I have a section where I suggest a number of reflection questions for clinicians to look at and to for their own exploration, because we all have very strong bodily projections towards the maternal body, the maternal realm, the mother-child dyad. It is one of the few things, I think, that elicits the strongest and most unconscious projections we all have towards that. And as clinicians, if we're going to be working in this, we need to examine that. And I think with my experience is that with practice, the more you have examined this, you can get more at home in that. You can become less overwhelmed by it. If you become more familiar with this, I call it like the landscape of the perinatal or the maternal bodily reactions. Often the somatic countertransference are going to be about, of course, your own story related to reproduction, your own reproductive journey, your own relationship to maternal bodies, whether you have one yourself or not, or are one, or your own relationship to other mothers in your life, and how much you can tolerate sitting with that, how much you tolerate the terror of that. Rosemary Balsam is another writer that I'm very inspired by, because her writing is very inspiring, because she really goes into the intensity of the bodily landscape of the perinatal. And reading her was actually crucial for my development of this work, is that she just writes with this like natural, like, this is the landscape. We have to get used to it. We have to be in it. We, dare I say, desensitize ourselves, but it's like we have to get into it and cultivate an awareness of this is that field of these very intense bodily, affective, often nonverbal or unconscious meanings. And I think clinicians can train that. You can practice that and you can get better at it.
Yeah, the book has a number of graphs and charts and things that are really, really helpful. Gulzar, did you have questions that we haven't gotten to that you'd like to ask here as we...
You know, it's funny, as an analyst who has always defended being a psychoanalyst in a OB practice working with perinatal women, I am finding myself really drawn to everything that's a little more physiological that you talk about. So I would love to touch on either, and I know we have limited time left, the nervous system expansion stuff that you were talking about. I'm really interested in that. And also just maybe even briefly just something on the perinatal inflammation and its relationship to depression, because that also really blew me away.
Yeah, certainly. So when you dig into the research, you see that this the inflammation changes, the very delicate changes of pregnancy and postpartum poses these like enormous shifts in the body, where you have to first, in the first trimester, there's like a increase of that inflammatory response, and then it lessens and then comes back a lot in the third trimester getting ready for delivery. And it's like the body just does its thing, right? Like these things are very much very powerful, and we know there is a link between mood and depression and inflammation. It's very delicate. So it's like the piece of trauma is a big piece there, because trauma is like that accumulated stress. I like the term allostatic load, because it talks about like traumatic stress is like this, the accumulated stressor on the bottom of body, on the systems. They kind of build up over across the lifespan. So it's like how much of an inflammatory burden are you carrying as you're then going through that transition? So we have to think about how addressing the inflammation piece in all the ways, like all the ways, whether that's very concrete, you know, the going, your recovery, the OB, the lactation consultant, the psychiatrist, all of that. And then on that psychological, relational level, where that the, as many experiences of relational support, what we know, attunement, holding, safety, where you can, that the therapeutic alliance, it has an anti-inflammatory component. It's probably not, you know, not only just doing a lot of very deep reflection in and of itself. I think there needs to be much more of just the whole relational holding and attunement. And I mean, we have so many wonderful terms in the psychoanalytic literature about this that I'm escaping me right now. I'm sure you can think up a lot of how this has been expanded on in the literature. But those experiences where it's so nonverbal, in the sense of, you know, that containment, good old beyond, right? The containment function, we know it connects to that, the it's anti-inflammatory in nature. And that's where I am. The somatic techniques are all about that. And even if you don't, you don't have somatic training, and you're not interested in kind of adapting specific somatic techniques, things like that, doing a lot of somatic work just on your own, and then, you know, continuing all the good, all the great analytic tools we have, can really make a difference. I think a lot of, you know, people work analytically and who are maybe not going to go about and get, you know, do like somatic stuff, could still really, for their own carrying that, you know, for their own experience of expanding their capacities. We know it's heavy to do analytic work. It's hard on the analytic body.
I really like that idea, because I like the idea of how if we are going to be the container, we have to be able to like embody it ourselves, and in that transfer it, whether or not you're actually doing the somatic room in the room with the patient.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard the idea of the container being anti-inflammatory. So now I have I love new ideas.
I believe it. I certainly believe that. I stand by that.
Good. Since we are at the end, Helena, is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd like to share for the listeners who are learning about the book?
Well, I mean, I'm of course very excited to share it, and so happy to get an opportunity to talk about it. And I'll be also, you know, developing, you know, more trainings in the area. I'll be working more on I have another project I'm working on, which is to go into not so much the maternal perinatal, but specifically, or more broadly, embodiment and the way this whole topic of the somatic in the field of psychoanalysis, that I'm seeing some really exciting changes going on. And I want to very much be part of that conversation. And I think we're moving towards a big shift with the body more and more. And I'll be writing about that in the coming year. I have a book project on that too.
Oh, good. So you'll come back and talk to us about that book.
Certainly.
Great. We have been talking with Dr. Helena Vissing. Her new book, Somatic Maternal Healing, Psychodynamic and Somatic Trauma, Treatment for Perinatal Mental Health. Dr. Vissing, thank you for joining. Golzar, thank you for the help.